Welcome into the Best in Paranormal Podcasting. This is Darkness Radio. I'm your host, Tim Dennis. Great show today, folks. We have a wonderful show today. As a matter of fact, we're going to talk a little bit about the paranormal in general. We'll talk about ghost spirits. We'll talk about near-death experiences. We'll talk about the other side. We'll talk about belief. We'll talk about skepticism. We'll talk about your own paranormal sensitivities today with my guest, Kieran Stanislaw Mace. The book is right here, and it's a wonderful one, folks. I got the privilege to read it over the past couple of days, and I'm going to encourage you to go click on the link in the description of this program and go read it to yourself. Paranormal Perspectives, Paranormality, Normalizing the Paranormal. And it is a wonderful book about Stan's journey. And we're going to talk about Stan and his journey. And I want to tell you a little bit about Stan here. As a matter of fact, he's had quite the colorful life, and we're going to get into it with him here in just a second. He's a graphic designer by day and frequenter of the paranormal by night. Stan is also an artist, illustrator, podcaster, and author. As a matter of fact, we'll have a link to his podcast as well, which is a great podcast that you can check out on YouTube. It's called Paranormal Perspectives. He shares his own and others' stories about the paranormal world. He's born in Oxford from a family of British, Sardinian, and Polish heritage. I got a little Polish in me, too. Maybe we'll connect on that as well. I don't know if he's ever been to Minneapolis, but we'll have to check into Kramarczyk's together if he ever comes this way. And grew up in the suburbs of Botley, studied at Matthew Arnold School, and spent much of his education amongst the dreaming spires of Oxford, studying at Oxford and Cherwell Valley College, and later at Montfort University. He's married with two children. And dreamed to share his experiences with the world by using creativity to help people find the spark of excitement in their own pursuit of knowledge so that his kids and others may grow up in a more peaceful world. So, ladies and gentlemen, let's welcome in Stan Mace to the program. Stan, how you doing?
Hey, thank you so much for having me. And wow, what an introduction. Thank you so much for that. Also, yeah, kudos for your pronunciation of my name as well. It's a tricky one.
Well, I could give you my original one from off the boat, but I'll digress. actually ours got changed quite a bit. It was Saint Denis Tarangelo Bordeaux, but it's Dennis.
That's
now.
Quite nice. I like
yeah.
that.
Yeah, but it's Dennis now. But there's a bunch of different in there. But yeah, my great grandmother was. Trying to think now, I have to go back quite a few generations here, Stan, but she was born in Budapest, but she wanted to be Polish because that was upper crust, right? So she claimed always to be from Poland and got an audience twice with Pope John Paul II. So that was her big thing.
Wow. Yeah. What a privilege. Yeah. That's amazing.
So yeah, that was a big thing for her. So.
My granddad comes from Poland, and yes, sadly, I never met him because he died literally about 2 months before I was born, and he does play a part in my story, and that's something I'm kind of questioning, really, like, was he there through the start of this beginning into this paranormal world? But yeah, I use his name, Stanislav, of course, that's my middle name, mm-hmm. and I like to kind of put it on my book because it's like, for the life that he lived, I mean, he came from Poland back at the end of World War II and was a prisoner of war in Treblinka at the end of the Holocaust as well. Oh. So that's another big story. Yeah, so he had quite a challenging life. So I kind of use his name now to say thank you for my granddad for the life that he brought over to the UK and the opportunities it gave us, really. So I like to think that his name has passed through time into the future, into a more peaceful place, really. So in his way, it's like his name came from the concentration camps to the life that we live today and how privileged we all are, really. So, yeah, well, I'd love to tell his story one day as well. It's quite an interesting one, but yeah, bless him.
As you should. And maybe that's the second book, right?
Maybe. He does play a part in the sequel, because I'm working on the sequel at the moment. I won't share the title just yet, but I do extend the story because it is quite a complex one. So my first book, Paranormality, like, I had to cut it back to a certain extent because it's so dense, full of experiences. I didn't want to overload people with too much. So this kind of serves as an introduction to this new world and why I believe it is a worthwhile introduction that everybody should consider, at least, even the most skeptical people, just to give it a go. And the sequel will be kind of like what happens when you go beyond, essentially going beyond the beyond, basically, like what happens after this discovery, and you begin to face the paranormal without fear and learn more about the world that's around us, really. So, yeah, it's this crazy, beautiful celebration of life, really. Ultimately, it's not just a basic ghost story. It's so much more than that.
Well, Stan, my friend, you started off life with a little bit of turmoil. We'll put it that way. Or actually, your youth has started off with a lot of turmoil. And I'll tell you, I related to you because I myself grew up with a lot of turmoil. I grew up being bullied. I grew up in pain, and those two things I think you and I share. I had just myself relating to you. I didn't get hit by a car much like you did. We'll go over that accident here in a second. We'll talk about that accident here in a second. But I myself had what's called a slipped epiphysis when I was 13 years old. And I had to have a major operation in which I'd had my hip pinned back together. It had happened from
Gosh.
A growth issue. But in that, when I came back to school, it was 6 months of having to learn how to walk again. So as I'm reading your and nothing close to what you went through, and we'll talk about that here in a second, because but I want to set this up here. When I got back to school, the kids were cruel to me. They would trip me as I was trying to crutch my way around school. They thought it was funny to trip me and watch me fall, not knowing that they could have, they could have kicked my hip out of place. They could have destroyed whatever progress I was making. And I felt a lot about a lot of what you were putting in this book. So there's a lot of parallels as I'm reading your book, and I'm kind of journeying back to what you're writing here and feeling that outcast feeling. But let me get into what your story here. So I'm just telling you that I'm relating, as I'm reading your book here.
Yeah, I'm sorry you went through that, and even just meeting you for the first time, you're lovely. You don't deserve
Oh,
that,
thank you.
so don't
Thank
let that
you.
go against you.
You felt kind of like you were on the outside looking in, growing up, as it were. Tell me a little bit about as you were growing up before the accident. What was it about? Did you always feel like you didn't relate to other kids, or did you feel like maybe you had a more brighter personality than other kids, or other kids didn't relate to you? Or how do w tell me about that feeling.
Yeah, it's something I've never been able to shake, even now as an adult. Because when this event all happened that catapulted me into the paranormal, I was just five. So at five, you're not fully aware of the social cues of what's going around. You're still developing as a human. I do remember memories earlier than five. People do contend with the idea of a five-year-old remembering so much, but that just seems to be what I am, what I do. But I had quite a good life back then, so I have a lot of family in Sardinia. So I live over here in the UK, and every year we'd spend a few weeks with my family out there in Sardinia, and I had such a good time. I have so many memories of eating ridiculous amounts of food and being there with my family. Like in, I used to go with my uncle crab fishing. Like he used to walk us down this alleyway that would take us down to this lake that kind of linked into this open area of land, sorry, excuse me, open area of sea, basically. But anyway, we used to kind of pick crabs, put them in the bucket, walk up the hill. I remember in particular a dog they had called Dunga, which is a really weird name, but basically it was a stray they took in that could only walk diagonally, which was a problem, of course, because he wanted to walk straight home but could only walk sideways, this poor little creature. I used to love that dog. But anyway, I just had a great life then. I mean, living in Oxford, everything was pretty normal. I wasn't born into the richest family. Like we were quite poor, but we just, made ends meet, just lived life pretty normally, really. It was only until that accident that on my return, I just couldn't fit into the world again. And I don't think I ever will fully, but I think the only way I can heal myself is by accepting what I am now and stop trying to make myself something that is palatable or understandable to other people. Because, well, ultimately, this experience kind of made me what is classified now as being neurodivergent. Neurodivergent is obviously an umbrella term for a number of different cognitive abilities. But either way, it changed me. And the kids knew that growing up, and they could tell, like, I've for one had PTSD after having this accident, and so I was very panicky in certain situations. I didn't want people near me at certain times. I needed my space, and also this cognition change. I spoke very differently, and kids picked up on that. I'd use words in a really strange way in a strange order sometimes, and I still do now. But the people around me are just used to it, though. That I bring in really weird phraseology out of nowhere, but that comes with my connection to something else, let's just say. And I'll probably reveal this through this interview. So yeah, I mean, not everybody has a perfect childhood. I'm not entirely unique. It does happen to everybody, but we have our own individual pains. And as I mentioned on the podcast the other day, actually, it's a specific phrase, our scars form our shape.
Right.
And sometimes that's a good way to see things. Like, sometimes we look back and go, I wish I had that. I wish things were easier. But sometimes simply owning your scars and allowing them to be a marker of your journey and your success of your survival, I suppose, is a good way to see it sometimes. So that ultimately is kind of what I'm doing now. I hid my story. I didn't know who to tell my story to. I didn't have the language for it, really. It took a good few decades to get to the stage now where I'm able to explain something that defies known understanding. There were some comparables in there that may leave you guys scratching your heads, and I'm sure you know what I mean, Tim, anyway.
Yep.
From that story.
So
that's kind of my kind of little spiel anyway. But yeah, I was basically pretty normal, and then I changed.
And again, we'll get to the specifics of the accident here in a second, but it's you're right. You put it very eloquently. It's the scars that form our shape. It really is. It's the we almost are like a metal that needs to be hammered into form at the end that gets us to where we always think we're this, we should be the swan that just pops out, and we should just eloquently grace through life. And we even think as kids, these, unfortunately we put ourselves in these cliques and these pecking orders in school. And we think that I have my little emotional support. If you're watching on video, I have my little emotional support prints on my microphone, but we always think the beautiful ones are the ones who are graced and lucky in life and they go through, but you're amazed when you get to the other side, even after high school and college, that some people don't end up being graced after that forge, that educational forge, and they don't have the best life after school. And some people come out of that, educational forge, and they soar and they have an amazing life. And you think, how is it that happens? Right. But it just happens with some people, and some people are blessed. Some people, it just, they happen to stumble. And it's just a matter of, again, maybe half of it's luck, half of it is something else and divine intervention. The other half of it is hard work. You never know, right? I don't want to say it's a crapshoot, because it is. And I do believe there's intervention there. I do believe that there's, and I believe the other part of it is talent. I really do believe that it's life experience as well. It's how you roll with the punches. And I believe you, Stan, have rolled with the punches. You really have. And you've done a lot of self-discovery in what's happened to you.
Absolutely. I had to be kind of like the paranormal Rocky Balboa kind of thing. Like, you just keep on getting back up again, because I've had a number of hits through, like, my youngest years, really, over and over again. And you just got to keep fighting. So sometimes you do question, like, why was I born ultimately? If my life is just only purely suffering, then what's the point? Could I have just remained where I was before? But it's just when I began to think and research and began to almost, rather than fight my demons, walk with them, they began to make sense, because to me, they weren't really demons anymore after a certain point. When I began to delve more into what I am, they more were guides, teachers, I suppose. So sometimes teachers can be pretty harsh.
Yeah.
You do need them to propel you onto your journey to form that shape. So yeah, like, I'm really glad. It's kind of like, since I've released this book, speaking to many wonderful people such as yourself, really, who have actually responded to the book now, it's helped me to heal. Like, you guys are actually helping me. And this is a beautiful thing, because a lot of people get the book, they get the pain of it, they get the context around it as well, like why I'm giving extra detail, because I'm leaving you to decide. but they get ultimately at its core the most human element of it. It's an honest story about a kid that fell outside of time, basically, like just fell into somewhere liminal, met something that is far more powerful than himself, and discovered there's a lot more out there. And there's not just simply a lot more out there, there's a lot more to us as well. We seem to be this consciousness that seemingly seems to survive without the body, the vessel. And with that, my story kind of provides evidence of that, of me foreseeing certain things in very granular detail, in advance of me visiting it in reality, sometimes years later. So where am I getting this information from? How am I seeing these things in advance? It's pretty crazy, but yeah, now I look back and I kind of accept it. I'm glad that it's happened. And it sounds quite horrific knowing what I went through, but I'm really glad that it happened because I wouldn't be here today. And through having these conversations, it seems to be healing other people too. And that's a wonderful thing. If this book has just made one person go, actually, I thought my life was terrible. Maybe I might be going on a better path now. I think I have the strength to stand up and no longer fear the world and what it brings to me, and also the things that don't make sense. Maybe facing them head on and simply learning from them, being an observer, a student, if you will, rather than being afraid of the things that make no sense.
Right. Let's talk before we go to break about that fateful day, that accident, about what happened when you were five. Tell us how you remember that, about what happened that day.
These memories have been ingrained in me. So I relive these every time I tell these interviews. So I'll try my best to tell them. And I'm kind of walking through it as I tell you, of course. So basically, I was in Oxford, on my way to my grandmother's house. I was at this pedestrian crossing. So it was a red light for cars, a green light for pedestrians, of course, implying it's safe to cross. I remember to the right of me, there was a line of vehicles already stopped. My mum was with me as well. So we began to cross the road together, and I was just in front of her. A vehicle, for whatever reason, decided to rather than stop, drove around the stopped vehicles straight through the crossing and hit me head on. It hit me head on because the moment before I was hit, I do remember this really strange thing. This is the first kind of part of the story is I heard a voice in my right ear that said, "You shouldn't be here." And I do wonder today, like, was something trying to prevent something from happening? Was this all part of some planned event? Maybe, I just don't know. But either way, just as I heard that, everything went black. And that's the moment where I was hit head on, because I kind of turned to look at the car. And yeah,
Oh.
not pretty. Thankfully, it only just narrowly missed my mum by just a few millimeters. It was pretty close. I remember the first thing was I was actually conscious for a moment, and I was in this big void, this infinite void even, and I was stood there thinking, where did mum go? Where are the cars? Where is the crossing? And I remember being there just for, it was almost like I was there for a few minutes. I wasn't there for long. And then suddenly I woke up again like a second time. And as I looked up and looked around me, I realized I was laid on the floor. These people were all surrounding me. There's like a ring of people. And I looked to my left, and my mum was being consoled by one of the members of the public. And apparently, one of the members of the public ran to the person that hit me with their car to pull them from the vehicle because they were trying to flee the scene as well. You could contend why they would do that. That could be fight or flight. They could not be thinking straight. I later found that that person wasn't a very nice person, let's just say, because yes, they could have done things very differently. But either way, they were stopped by the public and they did the right thing. But I remember being laid there and like experiencing a pain that I could never fully explain to you. And for a 5-year-old kid to feel that much pain,
Oh.
I wouldn't wish that on anyone. No kid. I have two lovely kids and I'm so grateful that hasn't happened to them. Hopefully it will never will happen to them. But it's a pain where you just wish you would die at that moment. You just don't want to be here. You want to quit immediately.
Yeah.
It's like that basically. And yeah, I saw my body in quite a bad way, and I'll save your listeners the details. But yeah, like my legs were like completely mush. So yeah, the ambulance was called. They were there within a few minutes, luckily, and they put me in, took me to the hospital. And yeah, they rushed me as quickly as they could. And again, incredibly painful journey. My legs were like jelly going all over the place in the ambulance. But to my knowledge, They took me to the emergency room, and I had to go into a number of emergency operations, like in stages, to stem the bleeding, to essentially stabilize certain organs, and begin to kind of bind together bone, and just all sorts of things were happening all at once. Thankfully, I wasn't conscious initially through, of course, that point, but I did find myself suddenly awake. And in my mind, I'd gone from being in the ambulance to suddenly waking up again. And it's the weirdest thing because during these operations, of course, I know my body couldn't have walked, it couldn't have moved in any way. Yet I found myself stood in this corridor. I'd suddenly woken up yet again. And I remember looking down at my legs, thinking, my legs don't hurt anymore. And I'm standing again. And I was thinking at that moment, I remember then even thinking, but that car thing happened. Was that a dream? Is this a dream? I began to look around and try and observe this place that I was in, and I instinctively thought, okay, look for my mum. Naturally, that's what you would do as a little kid. And as I began to look around, I realized that the reality looked like this reality, but there was something slightly different about it. Like there was a slight sheen, like I described it before as like solid light. There's like elements of light in the structure of the world around me. I didn't question it too much. Of course, I was young, so I was just living that experience. So I began to walk down this corridor, thinking that I could find somebody. To the right of me, I saw a little boy in this room, and he had a cast on. I don't know what he was doing, reading a book or playing with something anyway, but I waved at him to get his attention and shouted at him, and he didn't respond. You couldn't see me. I was getting really a bit weirded out at that point. Walked a bit further along the corridor and saw this little girl and did the same, and she didn't respond. At that point, I saw a doctor just pass by the room, the girl was in. I tried to get his attention and nothing. And I began to think, am I invisible? And so, I just continued to search. I went through like different hallways, and it's like I was walking for just, I felt like hours even. I went to different rooms just exploring this hospital, and I went down a couple of levels using the stairwell, and I eventually found myself approaching this room. And there were some kind of strange gadgets, and I don't know what they were, but I'll describe it now as an adult knowing what I know. It's like it kind of looked like there was some sort of security or something going on there. But either way, I was somehow able to pass through it. And I was there, stood in this hallway, looking at this room. And to me as a kid, I was just relating it to things that I knew. So to the right of me, I thought, oh, there's a wall full of washing machines. There's lots of holes in there and doors. So I thought, I'd assumed it was like my mum's washing rooms. That was my assumption because I saw clothes like doctor's coats and different objects, like medicinal objects left in there, like, and that was it. And that's when I felt that something was off about this room. Like, it's the best way I can describe it. It's like almost a predator approaching. Like, visually, I couldn't see anything, but there was something large there and so large that I felt like I was in danger. I couldn't describe, like, I mean, I've tried so hard to explain this over and over again, but I keep falling back to the word paradox, like something cancelling something else out, ultimately, light and dark, for example, like, living and dead. This thing, it was a paradox. It was almost a living paradox. It was very physically there and large, incredibly large, almost like the size of a planet, yet it didn't exist at the same time. So I couldn't see it visually, but I could feel it. And through feeling it, I could see it. It's a really weird thing. But that moment, I began to feel, okay, I need to go. Like, I don't need to be in this room. And that's when I connected with something that was there. So it was like a black hole, basically. I began to get sucked into something. And I met this entity that kind of out there in the beyond. It's like I slipped further beyond in this liminal place. And what I observed, it's like an entity that's connected with everything. It's like, I've described it before in like Norse mythology, they have the world tree connecting different universes. It's like it was acting like the thread between everything. Or maybe it was just showing an example of the connection to a wider universe. I'm not entirely sure just yet. But I remember the specific phrase. It was, there is no me and I, there is only we and us. And it was trying to explain to me, like, there's a wider connection. That's one thing that's always stuck with me. And as it began to kind of talk to me, it just began to show me things. And the thing is, it couldn't show me things at a speed I could comprehend. It just threw everything at the most insane speed. Like, imagine like all of the things you've learned in your entire lifetime being squeezed into a microsecond, like a nanosecond, and having that nanosecond stretched out over thousands of years. That's what it felt like. It's like so much information was being passed through me.
Like a huge download, Stan?
Kind of like that, yeah.
Yeah.
Imagine like, the fastest internet you can imagine today, like, I don't know, 1 gigabyte broadband. That's a pretty terrible example though, but imagine that, but like times a million. Like it was so used to this way of communicating. It could communicate instantaneously with everything and perceive everything. And me as a kid in that moment, I was only used to living in this linear life. I couldn't comprehend it. And to me, I met it with fear. And I wonder if the fear was my response to a much higher vibration, like, because I was at a lower vibration in that state, meeting something much higher. Like, what would your body do to something that, I suppose, for example, like, imagine an ant meeting a human. Like, have you ever considered how an ant feels?
Oh,
Does it feel fear to see the size of this human? Like, because it doesn't know what this human is. All it knows is its mass and its power. Could that have been my experience? I don't know. But either way, like, it kept feeding me more and more information. And it was like an overloaded socket, basically. Like, it's almost like I was heating up. And it got too much where, like, I was trying to almost comprehend being in multiple places all at once. Like, so I was seeing planets and stars and people and cities. And I'm not sure what the people were or the beings were. I wasn't there for long enough to be able to fully focus. And that moment where I was overwhelmed, I tried to kind of almost bring it down to a singular moment to try and just slow it down and have some sort of control. And that's where I found that I was flying, almost like, yeah, Superman style, I suppose. I was flying through the clouds and I could see like a city just in the distance. And the closer I got to it, I began to recognize the shape and I thought, oh, that's home. What I saw was like the dreaming spires of Oxford. I could see like the outline of Oxford University in the distance. I thought, okay, I recognize roughly where I am now. But as I looked down, I could see like there was a path underneath me and this area that I didn't know. It was new to me at the time. And I saw like a train yard underneath me as I flew over. And it was interesting because there's this bridge that went up over the train yard. A few steps went down and then ended up where this bridge was that went over this lake. And I basically came down to, I kind of lowered myself onto this bridge over this lake. And I noticed as I was lowering myself, I was aware of how aware I was, I suppose. It's like I could perceive every molecule in this place around me. Like I could feel everything, like the granular cracks of the concrete and the wire mesh fence. It was a really weird
Whoa.
over comprehension of what was around me and that I wasn't used to. But the interesting thing is, was as I landed, there were these teenagers on the bridge. And keep in mind, this is like 1990s where everybody used to wear tracksuits in Oxford. That was the fashion back then. But I remember like just landing and one of the teenagers turned and looked me in the eye. And that moment just jumped. And I realized at that moment, that person can see me. Maybe I'm alive. Maybe this is real. Maybe this, maybe that. I began to think about where I was and what was going on, at least beginning to try to. But the moment we kind of made eye contact, like it's like I was pulled back towards the hospital again. It's almost like it spotted me again. Like I'm thinking about like Sauron in a way, like the Eye of Sauron kind of spotting you and putting you straight back towards where you need to be. And again, I reconnected with that entity again and had that over comprehension where I could see everything like multiple states all at once. And it got faster and faster and faster and faster, and it just wouldn't stop accelerating. Like it's almost like it was infinite, though. It would never stop. And at that point, like I couldn't take it anymore, and I just tried so hard to think of my mum. I just kept thinking of her face and of home, and wanted to get out of this situation at this place that I was in between. And I kind of went blank at that point. It's like the memory ends in my mind, and I remember momentarily just waking up. Seeing that I was in bed, I remember kind of I was laid down. My legs were in casts. I had like one leg was suspended in the air. I had like metal rods going through my leg as well to hold the bone together. Again, this is 1990s medicine, though. Obviously, it's quite brutal back in the day.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
And then, yeah, to the left of me, I saw my mum. And I realized there she was there. And what I didn't know at the time was my mum had been there for a couple of days and she'd never left my side. And the hospital was so overbooked, like they had no beds free for her to use, no chairs even. They managed to get a wooden pallet and put it by the side of the bed. And that's what she was sleeping on for a few nights because she refused to go until I woke up.
Oh, jeez.
And if that's not a great example of a mum, I don't know what is. Like, it's like super parent, really. And she was always there. And she was the first person I saw when I came back to Earth. And at that point, yeah, I did remember, of course, the pain came back and I began to kind of be more in this body again. And I initially assigned this memory to, like, well, essentially a dream. That was the only way I could comprehend it then. That's the only way I could survive the situation, was assuming it was a dream. And yeah, this is when it begins to get really weird, where I start to align this with tangible evidence of it connecting with reality. So what happened was, a few weeks went by and I had other operations, and over time I was doing gradually better and better and better, and eventually I was at a point where I was disconnected from all of the pulleys and the things holding my legs up, and I could move around. And this nurse, bless her, she came to me and said, "Oh, you've been really good the last few weeks. Do you like a treat?" And I said, "Oh yeah, definitely." And she said, "Jump on this wheelchair. I'll take you on a tour of the hospital. Like, we'll have a look around and we'll look out the windows." And I thought, yeah, I remember, like, that was the first moment of just pure joy out of an incredibly dark experience. She put me in the wheelchair and took me around. I remember entering the first corridor, and that's where it hit me in that moment where the joy immediately left my body entirely, because I felt that weirdness again. What I saw in that hallway exactly aligned with what I saw in that outer body experience. In that moment, I didn't know I had an outer body experience. All I knew is that dream seems to be a real dream. Was I here before? I know in reality, in that moment, that was the first time I was going through that corridor. I may have been rushed through the hospital unconsciously, of course, to get me to where the ward was. I get that. But I had no memory of being through that. I couldn't have consciously recorded the information about being in the hospital. So yeah, as we continued down the corridor, I began to see the little details that match with this so-called dream. I saw the little boy to the right of me with his cast on in that room. I waved at him. He said, "Oh, hi." And I felt annoyed at that moment because I thought, "Hang on a minute, I just said hello to you the other day. Like, why can you see me now? Like, you ignored me the other day." I was almost kind of a bit annoyed at that point. So yeah, I continued further down and saw the little girl. Eventually, I was telling the nurse where to go. Like, I was telling her where to turn left and right, go down these. I wanted to go down these stairs, but of course, I was in a wheelchair, so we had to take the lift down, the elevator down. The weird thing is, I just kept going and going and going. I seemed to just know my way around this whole hospital. Eventually, we found our way to this area where it was like a secure area, so she couldn't take me further beyond this point. But I could see down the corridor, oh yeah, those are the weird kind of almost bleeping lights, basically. Like, it's almost like a security gate of some sort. And I could see just further beyond there, through this doorway, I could see the actual opening to the room that I saw, the room with the so-called washing machines that were in there, and the coat and all. I could just about see it, and I thought, hang on a minute, that's where I met this entity. And I began to feel like the most rawest fear, that primordial fear building up, because I thought, is it there waiting for me? Are we still in that dream, that so-called dream? And I remember just screaming and screaming and screaming, because I mean, my best understanding at the moment now, it's ontological shock, the psychological term for a one's person's ultimately their reality being unmade. It's like they had a particular belief system and understanding that of the way of the world work that the world works, excuse me. And having that completely unmade in that moment, like, it leaves you with nothing, and you don't know what to grab onto, what to almost give you reason for being, for existing, I suppose. Like, that's a lot for just a 5-year-old kid to take in. That's a lot. So yeah, that was my first evidence of, like, this began to align with reality. Sorry, did you have a question?
That no, I'm terrified along with you. So, I mean,
Yeah,
I
sorry
know, I
about
don't know. I remember
that.
reading it in the book, but to hear you describe it is absolutely terrifying. Anyone who's ever had that experience and has, I believe you describe at one point in the book, you describe it as, instead of déjà vu, it's a form of déjà vu, right?
I love that expression. Yeah.
It's like you said, you come apart. You know, you can absolutely come apart. It can absolutely unravel you. Mentally, physically, even spiritually, it can unravel you to know that you're putting yourself right back there. Yeah. Yeah. and to think of the tender age you were at that time, it's absolutely frightening, you know, to read those words and to put yourself in your body at that time and in your mentality, to think that you're right back there. But not only is it validation to go, whoa, but you go, oh my God. Right?
Yes.
Yeah. It's absolutely frightening, Stan. Let's take our break. When we come back, we'll talk about what exactly is happening to you after this accident and what exactly is burgeoning inside you and how you're adjusting. And then we'll talk about, I have a very important question for you at the end of this whole thing, because, you know, there's some of us who are, I don't want to say dead inside, but we psychically we're dead inside, you know. There's a portion of this audience that's listening that are hardcore skeptics, but yet still go out to asylums, or they go out to these paranormal trips, and they go around to different haunted locations searching for an answer out there. And they want validation that there's something out there, right? But yet they continue to deny, right? The first thing, you show up with some sort of meter, you show up with a cat ball, you show up with something, and over again, it's pestering. It's show me something, you know, do the trick. But yet when you get the trick done, I didn't see anything. So I have a very important question for you at the end of this, Stan.
Okay, I think I have an answer ready for you already, but yeah, okay.
Okay, so we'll talk about that. We'll talk about skeptics and cynics and the constant head bashing, if you will, when it comes to that, and what it may potentially take for that person to open up. We'll talk about that at the very end of the program. This book, folks, wonderful book, and we have a link in the description of this program. I want you to go ahead and pick it up. My guest is a wonderful one as well. The book is Paranormal Perspectives, Paranormality, Normalizing the Paranormal. Kieran Stanislav Mace is my guest. He's the author of this book. I want you to go get this book in the break. When we come back, we'll talk about his journey after he's had this near-death experience. And he's now going to be moving on. We're going to talk a little bit about his support system at home and a little bit about school and whatnot. And then we're going to move into a discussion about the paranormal in general, because I want to talk to Stan about how this relates to believers and skeptics. I want to get into this discussion of believers and skeptics in the paranormal and how we make that transition, because I've noticed one thing with this show over 20 years, and that is you can go in a skeptic, but do you necessarily stay a skeptic? That's coming up next right here on the best in paranormal podcasting. This is Darkness Radio. But first, folks, I forgot to mention our sponsor today is Jelly Bean and Julia's over in Coon Rapids. That's right. Jelly Bean and Julia's is the spot and the place to go when you're looking not only for a good meal, but for good company and for a place that'll treat you like family. Absolutely. There's some great specials going on right now over at Jelly Bean and Julia's. I'll tell you what, for today only, over at Jelly Bean and Julia's, you still have the appetizer specials that were going on for the rest of the week. And you do have the specials on drinks as well that we had been pointing out earlier in the week. As a matter of fact, happy hour, 25% off all appetizers, including appetizer sampler, half price single pour well drinks, half price Mick Golden Light, Coors Light taps, and half price domestic cans and bottles. Tomorrow, folks, I know I harp on this repeatedly, but there's a reason why. It's one of the top five meals you'll ever have in your life. The smoked prime rib dinner, and it's every Friday night. There's a reason why. This is, folks, Corey smokes this in their walk-in smoker. First of all, if you've ever seen a walk-in smoker, it is impressive. But this walk-in smoker houses this 14 or 16 ounce prime rib. It smoked for 14 hours beforehand. It's served fresh to you starting at 4:30 at that restaurant. Every Friday night, they serve it until it's gone. 14 or 16 ounce prime rib. You get a Boston baked potato with it. You've got the tequila berry salad, that classic tequila berry salad with the sweet and tangy tequila berries dressing. They've got the croutons, the bacon bits and whatnot. You're not going to walk out of that restaurant hungry. I'll guarantee you that. Again, that dinner is served from 4:30 until it's gone. And then, of course, on Sunday, you've got breakfast on Sundays only. You've got chicken and waffles and much, much more. You've also got the wonderful brisket and hash baked, but the brisket and hash potatoes and whatnot. You've got a lot going on there with breakfast on Sundays at Jelly Bean and Julius. If you've got more questions about what's going on at Jelly Bean and Julius, jellybeanandjulius.com. We've got a link in the description of this program, jellybeanandjulius.com, where they will treat you like family. Go ahead and go there and get yourself a great meal. All right. When we come back, more with Stan Mace. The book is Paranormal Perspectives, Paranormality, Normalizing the Paranormal. It's right here, a link in the description of this program. When we come back, we'll talk about skeptics and believers and whether you can remain a skeptic in this field throughout time. Next on the best in paranormal podcasting, this is Darkness Radio.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on two purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Now with McDonald's, wake up to a $4 breakfast meal deal. Wake up to a sausage McMuffin or sausage biscuit to hash browns and wake up to a hot coffee. Get your $4 breakfast meal deal.
Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. Prices may be higher for delivery.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on two purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Now at McDonald's, a McDouble is only $2.50. So you can get your gym gains on or just get lunch for only $2.50. Get more value on the under $3 menu.
Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. Prices may be higher for delivery.
Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on two purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Now at McDonald's, a McDouble is only $2.50. So you can get your gym gains on or just get lunch for only $2.50. Get more value on the under $3 menu.
Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. Prices may be higher for delivery.
Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
Welcome back to the best in paranormal podcasting. This is Darkness Radio. I'm your host, Tim Dennis. My guest is Stan Mace. This is the book right here, Paranormal Perspectives, Paranormality, Normalizing the Paranormal. And we've got a link in the description of this program so you can pick up this wonderful book. When last we left you, we were talking about the accident that Stan had had when he was just a young lad that pretty much launched him into his paranormal journey. I want to move forward quite a bit here, Stan. And I want to talk, and we're going to breeze quite a bit forward. As you're into your younger years, you develop an interest in art. And that interest in art comes from really from you being hospitalized. You're given art supplies because really you can't go anywhere, right? And you discover you have a talent for art. And this talent for art starts to burgeon, and to the point where you even, didn't you draw on some glass that ended up being permanent?
Yeah, I got the nurses in trouble with the warden of the ward, essentially. It was worth it though. It looked really nice-ish.
There you go. So you added something nice to the hospital there.
Of course.
And so you've got something that at least if life is going to be cruel, you have this gift that if you have to retreat within yourself, mm-hmm. you've got something that can console you, right? I know it's kind of a bad thing to say. At least some people may say, well, Tim, that's kind of a cruel and unusual thing to say. But I mean, I can relate. In my life, I had a guitar, right? I mean, that's what I retreated to. I had a guitar and I had comic books. That's to me, that's what I had. But in that, I always found, and correct me if I'm wrong here, Stan. It's the repetition of the pencil. It's the strumming of a guitar. It's the repetition that causes meditation. It's the meditation that causes you to go inward. It's going inward that triggers the gift. Am I wrong?
Yes, that is ultimately the crux of it. It's simply a way to separate from the forefront of your consciousness to then kind of let that, you know, almost keep it busy, basically, where, you know, the adults enter the room, basically, like your higher consciousness seems to be able to kind of come out and, you know, let herself out more freely. And to me, that's the beauty of art, really. It's you're connecting with something much more than yourself. Not necessarily a god of sorts, though, maybe more just the higher version of yourself, the higher version of your consciousness, really. So art is a beautiful gateway. And also with that, you know, as you said, it's literally one of the many reasons where it allowed me to survive that time in hospital. It's the only way that I could survive the pain. So I noticed that the more that I drew in hospital then, the less the pain hurt. And to me, like I mentioned specifically the phrase bloodletting of pain, I was just letting it out as ink onto the paper, basically. And it's strange because as I returned, like my brain was working very differently. And at least one of the positive things from this experience was this enhanced cognition. And also this, you know, with that, you know, advanced abilities in art from a very young age. So I came back kind of like an overnight artist, basically. And the teachers at school knew that when I eventually left the hospital and started school, they could see that, of course, I was dealing with PTSD still. That's one part of it. But I seemed to just be able to draw things very easily from memory or come up with images that I haven't seen before. And I think now looking back on that time, that it was me as a child with my very limited vocabulary and limited comprehension, really. It was just a way where I could draw images to at least tell part of that story of what I felt and what I saw out there in the beyond. Yeah, I really wish I kept some of those drawings from an early age. I think they're in my mum's house somewhere locked away, and I kind of need to scan those and share those with the world. But it's my way of telling the world I'm hurt. I'm hurting and I don't understand why. And nobody can understand it. And even though people want to understand it, they don't. Because mm-hmm. I'm so different. I almost feel like I'm not human in a way. Like, I know that I am, you know, but it leaves you feeling very different. Like you can't fit in. Like, yeah, you have this, you know, advanced ability. Like, yeah, people think, oh, wow, it's great. You know, I can see you love drawing pictures are really good. Can you draw me a picture? Like, for some reason, I spent a good few years at secondary school drawing The Simpsons. everybody loved The Simpsons, though. For some reason, I just knew how to draw The Simpsons, so I drew The Simpsons for everybody all the time just to appear popular temporarily. But really, like, there was something else going on ticking in the background as I began to kind of delve into this memory, this download that I received, because it was so... Whatever it was that I met out there and the download that I'd received, it gave me information that was so compacted. It's taken decades and decades and decades to just filter through that information to try and decompress and understand like just layers of this thing. And I do feel like I have a better understanding of what I was shown now, but I don't think I'll ever truly know exactly everything it needed to tell me, but I'm just being sharing things as I uncover that. So, like I say, through my art, it's something more. And I don't know if you've seen yet, Tim. Anyway, I hope I'll share with you after
Yeah,
this call.
please,
But
please.
I've been making kind of psychedelic art the last few years, actually. Like, it was leading up to the writing of Paranormality. I just had this obsession where I was just letting out this kind of, I don't know, it's almost like my art is a representation of the energy that I felt. And I've created the most ridiculous pieces. I don't even know what they are, what they mean, but they exist. Every time I made these pieces, I felt a bit more at peace with this story. So yeah, like I say, I'll share with you. But art is a wonderful thing, and I'm hoping now, like, as I heal from this experience and move on to the next stage of my journey, I would love to arrange some sort of an art course where I can teach people. Like, you don't have to be a spiritual person though, but I'd love to deal with people who have PTSD or various different forms of trauma to help them heal, because I want to be the person that couldn't be there for me, like in the now, basically, because at least I have an understanding of the way these things work. Sometimes you have a kind of trauma that it can't be measured or understood by known psychology, science. Like, it completely defies understanding of our current understanding. I mean, art's a wonderful thing. Like, think about the greatest artists of the day, like, the Renaissance and all that. Some of them contended ideas to do with kind of philosophy. Some of them, it's, Mr. Da Vinci as well, like, bringing forward ideas to do with our technological development, really. Like, he was more of an inventor than an artist, really.
Absolutely.
Some of us speak to something else, like, it's not quite God, but it's about our true selves. What are we? We are this energy, and we can outlay that through the paper that we deal with.
Let me ask you this, Dan, because you're bringing forth a lot of interesting concepts. Da Vinci, I really do believe, channeled a lot of his inventions from somewhere else and then put them on the paper. I've talked to like Steve Vai about how he believes maybe he channeled some of his greater compositions from somewhere else. Like he got them from creative consciousness. Do you believe at times when you, like with your psychedelic art, do you believe you're getting it not just from the download that you got, but do you believe you're getting it from a collective consciousness, just not from this entity you met?
I do feel like I do. I mean, I'm not comparing myself in that way, saying I'm like the artists of, the great artists of the day. You're like, I'm nothing like them. But I seem to kind of be tapping into something, at least a portion of what they do tap into sometimes. And when I form these pieces, I'm in another place entirely. I don't feel limited by the thoughts of my brain, because I feel like my thoughts in this brain can only be so fast. There's limitation, and there's almost like a bottleneck, I suppose. When I create these pieces, I don't feel the bottleneck that I do feel in day-to-day life. I feel like I'm just, I would like to say thoughtless, really, though, but I know that'll be interpreted a different way. But almost like I'm without thought, as in conscious thought of the conscious mind. I'm thinking in an entirely different way. And it's a wonderful feeling. It's really, really nice, actually. I like to derive some sort of positivity from this experience. But us people who return from that near-death state, we are always changed. And I do hope, kind of with me releasing the book and having these conversations, I'm part of educating people that we're just like you. We're all on that human experience, but some of us have the lid blown off and we see behind the scenes. Similar to, like, I don't know if you've ever watched The Truman Show. There's a particular scene where Truman accidentally sees behind the scenes because he changes direction, and he accidentally sees through the wall, and they close it up. You can see them behind the scenes having their coffee, and I love that movie. It's amazing. But sometimes it feels like that. You accidentally see behind the scenes, and like the gig is up. Like Oz is identified, the man behind the curtain, essentially. You begin to realize there's so much more to this beautiful reality that we're part of. And with that, that realization through the experience has made me very humble. Like, I kind of want to speak to skeptics as well, saying, like, for one, I was a skeptic of my own experience. My reason for skepticism is because I didn't want to contend with the idea that I knew something that not everybody else did, and I didn't want to or couldn't deal with this burden of knowing. That's kind of one part of it. But speaking to skeptics, it's completely okay to be skeptical of these experiences. If you haven't experienced it, I completely get the doubt. if you haven't seen a color that you've never, you know, another person has seen maybe that you haven't seen before, of course you're going to question, is that color, you know, real? Is it just the way you're perceiving it? Is it misinterpretation on your side? Am I ready as a skeptic to believe in these kind of things? Am I scared to know something beyond myself? Sometimes it can be a fear aspect. But for me, like, yeah, I kind of pulled back and didn't want to believe my own experiences because I couldn't handle it. And that's just my own personal reason. But at least know that as skeptics or believers, whichever you may be, just understand how incredibly limited our senses are in terms of understanding our reality. Like, we only have 5 known senses. Technically, I could argue 6. But either way, we see such a tiny substrata of a greater universe. We can never be a full kind of experiencer of this incredible thing we're part of. We can only analyze what data we have through our first-hand experiences. And, you know, some people will analyze data from other people, like, you know, vicariously, basically living those experiences. But we're never going to have an absolute to deal with. So it sounds quite awful, though, but whether you're a skeptical believer, it makes no difference, I suppose, because we're so limited in our view. But being humble and understanding our place in the universe and how limited we are, at least it is a good part of that journey and understanding, you know, how we're interacting and why we will always have skeptics, because no evidence will be enough. We can't perceive the evidence presented to us. We never will. Like, we may think, okay, I believe in a ghost because I saw it on video. Even our technology can only capture a certain bandwidth of light. It can only kind of capture things that are within our perceivable wavelength, you know, in terms of what we can see. So it'll always be that way. We'll always have skeptics because we're so limited, but just understand why you're a skeptic as well. It's a good thing to know, like, why are you a skeptic? Is it a fear-based thing? Is it a limitation of understanding? Did you have a bad experience with somebody that maybe took advantage of your beliefs as well? Like, all of that is completely valid. And also believers too, like, if you haven't experienced something but want to believe in something, there's nothing wrong with that too, whether you're religious or just spiritual, whatever it might be. We're all on our own individual path. Nothing is truly right or wrong. It's only for the individual, really. So I'm not here to tell you you must believe in everything that I've seen. I want to respect your journey. Like, you choose what you want to do with this life. It's not for me to tell you what to think. We're all in the same school. We're in the same school, but we're taking different lessons at different times, I suppose, is the best way to say it. So yeah, that's my little spiel.
No, that's perfect. You know, if I can backtrack for a moment, I know you talk about, you know, a little bit about, for lack of a better term, I'll say denial. But wanting to at first deny or being a skeptic yourself over certain things, or wanting to be a skeptic, even though you've demonstrated that you have this gift. And I understand that.
I realize how that contends against itself. It's like denying my own feet exist. You know, right, they're still there.
Right. But
I had this experience.
The only way I can relate to it is this, right? I mean, I can remember sitting in a doctor's office being told I was diabetic and then going, nope. And then them saying, well, you know, you're probably going to need medication, not only pills, but you're probably going to need insulin. And nope, I don't need to take that. And remember the doctor and the nurse looking at me like, are you nuts? I mean, I have all the evidence right here. I've got blood tests. I've got all these tests that say you are. I've got genetic testing that say it's on both sides of your family. I'm telling you, you are. And me saying, well, I don't think I really need that. That's essentially a skeptic or a cynic. Saying, sitting in front of you, you know, a denial just ain't a river in Egypt, right? And sitting in front of a doctor going, well, I don't think I really need to. And for a year, Stan, for a year, I didn't want to put a needle in my gut because I just didn't want to have to do that. And then I had a friend who came up to me and said, think of it as, you know what, putting a needle in your gut twice a day is the only way you'll be able to eat. That's the way you should look at it. That's the only way you're able to eat is if you follow the rules. Because if you don't follow the rules, then you shouldn't be able to eat. Think of it as something you have to do, not something that is an option. There's no option to this. That's just the way you have to live life. Because it's a reality. This isn't a game, right? It's reality. We're past the point of playing games now. This is real. You know, it's something that you have to accept. You have the evidence in front of you. They've showed it to you. It's there.
Yeah.
Right. You can deny all you want, but when somebody shows you overwhelming evidence over and over and over again, you can drop the act at any time. You know, yeah. It's up to you as to what's overwhelming evidence, right?
Yeah, absolutely. That makes sense to me. And always kind of flipping that point of view, really. Like, imagine if you lived in a world where everybody told you that you don't have diabetes, that diabetes doesn't exist, and you yourself believe that you don't have diabetes yourself, yet you're seeing evidence of that through the way your body is reacting to certain foods that you're eating, your insulin levels and so on. And comparatively, that's the way like experiences feel sometimes, like you're feeling and seeing evidence of things that are impossible. Everybody around you tells you that can't happen, yet you're seeing evidence of that.
Yeah.
And you have to kind of put the mask on to tell yourself, okay, that can't happen. That isn't happening, but it's there.
Yeah.
Sometimes you just need to listen to your gut and go with your body. So, I mean, I'm not giving medical advice here. Also, don't take it literally as well, though. But yeah, obviously, you know, you listen to your body. You know what's right and what's wrong.
Right.
Obviously, listen to the experts. But I'm also just, it's more of a metaphor, really. Like, it does feel like that's the way the world is sometimes, that we're told... We're almost defined. Yeah, the parameters are defined for us from a young age. Like everything is canned. Because I was raised Catholic originally, and nothing against any Catholics out there. Still love you all anyway. I always have a lot of respect for it. But the world was outlined for me from a very young age. I told exactly what was and what wasn't possible, what was bad, what was good, and that was it. So no thought needed for me, at least from an early age. Anyway, everything was readily thought out for me. Canned philosophy. And then I contended with something that was impossible, that they say can't exist, can't happen. You know, that they, you know, I prayed to a certain God at the time and certain saints, but I met something else out there that wasn't the God that was presented to me or the energy of the saints. It was something so vast and ancient. I do believe it's one of many as well. There could be many out there. And it's something that's kind of indifferent. It was neither full of love nor hate. I don't believe it was evil. It was like, it was indifferent to the concept of humanity, because humans form the parameters of love and hate and descriptions of those feelings. And it's us ultimately giving shape to the void. We're putting a blanket around the unknown to give it shape, basically, when we put names on things and define our measurements. But this thing operated outside of our known understanding. It was so far beyond human understanding. So sometimes we just have that reality completely blown apart, and we kind of fight against ourselves, as I did myself, really. I fought against myself, thinking, okay, I've got this thing. I don't know what to do with it. I need to make sense of this thing. And it's that thing I mentioned, the burden of knowing that a lot of experiences do have. I was a skeptic of my own self, of my own experiences, which is just really bizarre. Like I mentioned, it's like you denying your feet exist, but your feet are right there.
Right.
We go, okay, well, no one else can see my feet, so I must go with that. That's what it was like. It kind of sucked, really. I was a bit stupid for doing that, really, because I should have really gone, okay, well, things are literally happening. I won't mention too much of the rest of my story as well, though, but yeah, something basically came back home with me from the hospital and affected my family. So I was getting evidence of things happening that other family members were experiencing too, as we had multiple witnesses for certain events. Just for example, we heard like whistling, inexplicable music, objects moving, objects, you know, literally jumping off the table and exploding. We had like the warping of reality, possessions. We had strange kind of inexplicable smoke as well, voices. It's a really weird few years to live in. And I realized this is an audio recording anyway, so I won't be able to show you what I drew, but do you mind if I show you after the show?
We'll have video up as well on our site, darknessradioshow.com, and on YouTube. Cool. So you can show the videos as well, Stan.
Well, basically, just to preview anyone that's going to be reading the book, if you do choose to, I met something in the hospital for the first time, and a particular event happened where I met an entity for the first time. It seemed to have followed me back home after that event as well. And I made a drawing of it, and it took me a few years to come face to face with the thing and put it to paper, basically. But meet this guy.
Wow.
It doesn't have a name. It's not particularly, it's not particularly the friendliest things. But this thing I used to see in my house for many years after that caused chaos, basically. Jeez. It caused a number of issues. And I do kind of take you through that journey in the book of like what it felt like people like skeptics could say, why weren't you there with a camcorder? Why weren't you there recording these things? That's a valid question. But when you're in the moment, all you're doing is trying to survive. You're just trying to live. And you're in a world where no one is out there to help you. There's no emergency service you can call to help you, unless you believe in the Ghostbusters, which would have been really, really useful then, to be honest with you. Great film, by the way. One of my favorites, actually. And you were there alone. So the last thing you're thinking you're doing is recording it, evidencing. Or what if a scientist met me a few years later and needed evidence to analyze? I mean, wouldn't that be great to show that? But yeah, like, I was alone with this thing for a good few years. And even though the rest of my family could see the other things happening in the house, like the objects moving, the smoke, hearing the whistling and various other things, they couldn't see this thing. Only I could see this thing. And it sucked.
Yeah.
It was awful. And it's still an open question today. Like, what followed me home and why did it? Because it seemed to enjoy my suffering. That may be an explanation as to what it was and what its purpose was, but I still haven't come to a conclusion just yet. And also, what did I meet out there in the beyond? Like, was it God itself? Was it a higher version of myself, maybe? Was it extraterrestrial? Some people have posed that question before. Some people have assumed it's the devil. I don't personally believe in the devil, but some people may interpret it as that as well. Fine. But these things do happen, and you just got to talk about it. And it's, I do kind of pose, like, you know, I suppose repeat the message, really. It's okay to talk about the paranormal. And that's ultimately what I contend with, really. Like, do we need the word paranormal anymore? Because it seems to be, over the years, like, especially thanks to podcasts like yours, or radio shows more specifically like yours, people are more able to share their stories without too much judgment, without stigma. And I realize now, the more people that I talk to, they happen more and more widely than I thought. I wasn't alone in this experience, which is good and a bad thing, I suppose. But the word paranormal is a parallel to a defined normal. I do ask the question, who decided what normal was? But that's another conversation, really.
Right.
So parallel to normal, well, it's not really a parallel if a lot of people are experiencing these things that make no sense. It doesn't mean all events are paranormal. But if we can more openly talk about these things, we can assess and analyze and figure out what happened, what we can learn from these experiences. So, yeah, ironically, despite me having the word paranormal multiple times in my title of the book, I don't actually like the word paranormal, because I believe it's like an old word that belongs in the old world, really, because a long time ago, we didn't have the word paranormal. We had magic.
Yeah.
If we saw something that made no sense, we assumed it was magic. Like, right. You know, a long time ago, it was seen that only fire could be made by the gods.
Mm-hmm.
And today, of course, we have fire as and when we wish, unfortunately in bad instances as well. But either way, we do things today that could, a long time ago, be perceived as magic. What if the things that we're contending with, these paranormal stories like the ones I've shared with you today, is just another layer of our unknown reality? It's simply like, it sits outside of our perceptions. It doesn't mean it's parallel to define normal. It's just simply a natural part of our world. Could it be paranatural? And that's the thing. So hopefully, like, I'm hoping to change the word paranormal into something maybe different, so people could remove the fear from having these conversations and start learning about these kind of things. Stop worrying about spooky dookie all the time and start getting your teeth into learning more about this wonderful world we're part of. I don't feel scared of that horrible thing anymore, as I showed you.
Yeah.
I'm really glad to be talking about this now and healing through this.
I like paranatural. That's not a bad term. I like that. Yeah, if I can take a shot.
A psychologist mentioned it a while ago, actually. I think that should be the next phrase, paranatural.
Yeah. If I can take a shot, again, I'm no expert. No one is in this field. I'm going to take a shot at what that thing is that you drew.
Do you want me to hold it up again?
Yeah. Because, you know, in hospitals, there's a show that I was on. Yeah. Ooh. Okay. You can lower it.
Sorry about that.
No. I don't ever get scared, but having a look at it, it looks like, it's a darker entity for sure. And in the way you draw it, it does have a combination of a shadowy type look to it, but, you know, in hospitals, and it's, There was a show that I was on called Paranormal Night Shift that was on Discovery for a while. And I've had friends that have been on haunted hospitals. And the one thing that we hear about in hospitals is that there are lots of lower level entities that like to hang around hospitals, that like to feed on misery, feed on that lower energy, right? And because at the time you are a young burgeoning psychic with, I'll put it this way, a high level of ability, because obviously when you have your near-death experience, you just don't have that white light tunnel experience. You don't just go into the tunnel, see the relatives, come back like most people have. You obviously ripped through the tunnel and went and experienced something wholly different, right? You blew that thing apart, Stan, and went and had a whole different adventure, right?
I mean, yeah, I'm quite clumsy.
No, that wasn't clumsy, my friend. That was skill. I mean, you went to a whole different level, right? I mean, there's your alpha. Everybody is on this different zeta, right? You're alpha, right? I mean, you're on a special type. And I don't mean special as in not like, you know, they use a derogatory in school. I'm talking special as in X-Men special, right? So we're all down here having our experiences, near-death experiences. You're up here having yours. That entity was probably one of those lower level entities in the hospital that followed you home, that feeds on that misery. But because your light shines so bright, it didn't have enough power to affect you or your family. You're fending it off. Okay.
I've heard of that explanation before. So you're not the first one to say this. I'm really glad you came to that conclusion on your own, because there do seem to be some things that, I kind of use the expression goths at the graveyard. I mean, I actually used to be a goth for a while, actually. I did it very badly, though, but it's kind of that expression, really. It's almost like an obsession.
Yeah,
goth. And this entity, goth isn't, it seemed to draw power from misery and pain.
I read that in your book, and goth isn't in you. I mean, you related to...
I was a terrible goth. I tried being a punk. I was a better punk than I was a goth, to be fair.
You put it very, very eloquently in the book. And again, I'm going to have people go read this wonderful book. And here it is again, Paranormal Perspectives, Paranormality, Normalizing the Paranormal. You put it eloquently in the book, my friend, in this. Goths and punks are amazing people. They're wonderful people. And
that's
and
so much
that
fun.
Their personalities are wonderful. They're welcoming people. The community is amazing. But the look is not you, because you shine light from behind your eyes, and that's a darker culture. It's a darker look, and it's not you. So
I appreciate that.
Yeah.
No. Thank you. That means a lot. So I'm not used to having compliments. It's like a British thing. Like we don't tend to take compliments very well. We don't really know what to do with them, but thank you either way.
Yeah, you're welcome. That's all you have to say is thank you. That's all you have to say. I know. I never used to be able to field them either. I was like a clumsy center fielder. If you would have hit that one at me, I would have dropped it. Yeah.
No, I kind of wonder, because when I was contending with this entity that was affecting the way I saw reality back then, I was a goth for a while because I was in that world, basically, so I felt like that anger needed to be outlet in the culture that I was part of. So in a way, I felt like that was me being affected by the entity back then. But like I mentioned, you know, like you mentioned that you saw in the book, like when I met the actual goth community, they're the most nicest, sweetest people. Like we used to go meet at the pub. We used to go to this place, it doesn't exist now, called the Glock in Oxford. It's where all the goths and punks used to meet. The place absolutely stank. Like, it was incredibly dirty. It was falling apart. It was absolutely grimy as anything. But I met some of the most happiest and lifelong friends there as well. So, honestly, if anybody out there is worried about goths and all that, if you walk by a goth today, maybe have a chat with them. You'd be surprised how friendly they are. If they start shouting abuse at you and chasing you, maybe just happens to you as a bad one. So either way, play it safely. But either way, we have our own journey, really. But I'm glad that there's light at the end of the tunnel now from this experience. That was, this happened when I was five. I'm 40 years old now. So that was 35 years ago. So it's taken me 35 years to just scratch the surface of this experience and begin to understand what truly happened and kind of own it, really.
Now, what you met... what gave you the download, I think, is either one or two things.
And go for it.
Extraterrestrial, possibly. But I think that's not necessarily it. You either met the creator or something just a slightly lower. That's my guess. I think you either met the big guy or you met something slightly lower than that, who one of his assistants who said, you know what, I'm just here to kind of sort you out and let you know what the deal is here. I'm going to give you what you need in order to start you on your path. You're not going to understand all this, but I'm going to put what you need to start you on your journey and slam it in your head. This is going to be way too much for you now, but as you get older, it's going to start to pop up in different places in your journey, and it will manifest.
Yeah. And through these interviews, things are beginning to come up, and I kind of predicted that things will start spilling out. I tend to say certain phrases at certain times, and you'll probably notice I use very strange phrases through this interview. Sometimes as I'm speaking, something else is talking through me at times. So I've tried to kind of get to know my, they call them spirit guides nowadays anyway, yes, but something that, you know, a familiar, I suppose, that, you know, it seems to operate with me. It could be another level of myself, maybe offering advice or just nudging me in a certain direction, but I do believe it is something separate to me. I don't really tell many people about it though, but yeah, it's something I'm trying to kind of mull over myself and get to understand what it is entirely. It's nothing bad, of course. But yeah, I do know that it likes to call itself Compendium. It's more of a description of its purpose, really. It is the information gateway, like almost to the Akashic Records. I don't know if you've heard about that theory as well. I've visited the Akashic Records myself. It's good. No library late fees. That's the big benefit there. But yeah, but either way, I seem to kind of like through these conversations, like outlet something that's kind of like Compendium itself. It's helping me to understand that learning. It's almost like helping me to filter and maybe pre-choose some things. So, for example, I use in this conversation, our scars define and form our shape. And that's a specific phrase from this thing I've been picking away. It's something I mentioned in an interview a couple of days ago for the first time. It just came out of nowhere. But it so perfectly summarizes our experience in this life, really, and how we should, rather than fight our experiences and blame ourselves and blame others for things that go wrong that's out of our control, own it, live it, and know it's part of your rich tapestry that makes you what you are. So each and every one of us out there are beautiful, beautiful human beings, like fallible, imperfect, trying to strive to be better. Some of us are having a terrible time right now. Some of us are having the time of our lives. Either way, just owning your imperfections is a beautiful part of our evolution, really. And I suppose imperfections as well is down to your perception, really, because personally, like I, for many years, when I was younger, I didn't like the way I looked. And, you know, a lot of people have issues with their body, about what they represent, you know, about what they assign to in terms of identity and all sorts of different things. And the only time where I began to truly separate from that was me beginning to delve into this knowing. I'm okay with how I look now. I'm just a regular dude. I mean, I have a humongous nose. I mean, all the better to smell with, though. And I used to find that to be like a really annoying thing years ago. I didn't like that about myself. Now I couldn't care less. Like, I love this body. I'm really grateful to have it. I'm very lucky, but it's not me. And so through this delving as well, I began to separate this idea of consciousness. And we seem to, of course, with my evidence from my near-death experience, I know that we're separate. But that learning can help me to kind of come to peace with who I am and be at peace, like saying, okay, I can dress as whatever I want. At the end of the day, it's still not me. And you just got to love the car that you're in. And I use the description like, you know, can we mention brand names on here? I don't want to get in trouble.
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah. Go ahead.
So just think about American cars. Like if you're a driver, like say you drive a Ford vehicle, when you get to your destination and you leave your vehicle and say you enter the office for the first time, they go, oh, hi, Ford. They go, hi, Tim. Because they know that you've left your vehicle and you've used that vehicle to transport you, but that vehicle isn't you.
Yep.
And that's the same way that I see the human body. So with respect to the human body, you know, it's there for a reason. It's part of my beautiful experience. But I haven't put all of my eggs in the basket of Stan, basically. I am not, you know, I'm just Stan at this moment in time, but it isn't everything that I am, basically. And that brought me peace and understanding that. So, yeah, I can just wear anything, do anything. It just doesn't matter. Like, you know, as my granddad used to tell me, like, if you can't decide what to wear, make sure you wear enough to not get arrested. That's my baseline anyway. So from there, I'll wear anything, I'll do anything. It doesn't matter. But at the end of the day, that separation kind of gave me power, basically. It made me realize, actually, I'm just part of this beautiful tapestry. I know what I truly am. And I broke away from the world that taught us that everything that we are is in this body, encased temporarily in time, and that everything we should do should be for that body. And if it doesn't look in a way that we're you know, happy with, and we spend all of our time trying to change it and spend our lives being miserable for it, take a separation and just know who you truly are. But again, that doesn't also, you know, go to speak for people who have various medical ailments and issues as well. It's not like you should say, okay, I'll just separate from that. Obviously, look after your body, do everything that you can to maintain it and look after it and love it. But just, we need to kind of all know who we actually really are. One of the bigger learnings, I think, I learned on the journey.
To go one step further with the car journey, as you get older, it's easier to see through the windshield and see exactly who's driving. So
Yes. That's great. Actually, great phraseology. I like that. Yeah. You can see through the windshield and you can be more aware of who's essentially driving that vehicle. Yeah. That's interesting.
Yeah.
Yes.
So that's one way to put it too. Okay. So I said at the beginning of this segment that I had one question for you here. And I think as we get close to the end of the program here, it's probably a good way for us to start to wrap it up. And that's this, as we have people who are investigating out there and they're skeptics and they feel like they're lifelong skeptics. I noticed this one trend here, Stan, and that's this. I'm noticing the trend and it's becoming a thing now. If you watch paranormal TV, whether it be where you are in the UK or where I am here in America, the trend is slowly swinging to where every paranormal TV show is a skeptical show to where there are more shows that are believer shows. And I find it a little refreshing, to be honest with you, because I'm finding too, as I've been in this field for quite a while, I got a little sick of the hardcore skeptic and cynic shows. Right. Not that I think everything should be open and you should believe everything that gets thrown at you, but it's healthy to question. But at the same time, I think it's okay to believe. It's okay to have some sort of faith. It's okay to believe in something. But for the skeptics and cynics out there, do you think someone could be a hardcore skeptic or cynic their entire life? Especially if they look at the end of their life or know that the end of their life is coming. Do you think eventually every skeptic or cynic eventually becomes a believer?
I suppose when you say this entire life, are you defining this life or are you defining other lives? Because ultimately, regardless of our experiences, what we do or don't believe in, we'll all come to the same conclusion anyway, regardless. It just depends on what point of the journey you begin to realize actually what's really going on behind the scenes.
I mean, they always say there's no atheist in a foxhole, right? I have a lot of listeners and viewers of the show that are hardcore atheists. I respect what they think, right? But I wonder. I really do wonder at times. Can you hold that stance from now to the grave?
You can. It depends on your reasons for being. Like some people that's their comfort blanket, essentially. Like I'd rather believe there is nothing than put my eggs in one basket and say there could be something. If that brings them peace and understanding, you know, enjoying this life, then have at it. There's nothing wrong with that. It's just the same as believe. If you believe in a certain religion, if that brings you peace and joy, understanding in your time here, that's fine, as long as whatever you're doing in this life is bringing you along that journey. So yeah, there's every chance that people can go from belief to skeptic or from skeptic to believer. We're always ongoing, we're always changing, we're always comparing new information and learning new things every day, because there may be points in this conversation where I made some statements now that a week from now I could have a completely different view. I'm not absolute and always in like one particular moment. And that's what kind of frustrates me as well, is people aren't aware of the fact that people do change. And people could say, okay, well, 10 years ago you said X, Y, and Z, but you know, now you're saying this and it's completely different. So therefore you must be lying. Well, no, I'm still just trying to learn. I'm still learning just like you.
Right. Right.
That's simply put. So I think people seem to just want things to not be real in that regards as well. So there's a bit of a resentment as well. So there's like a personal thing that filters in sometimes as well. And everybody has their own story. I was a skeptic myself. I've gone from being very religious to being kind of skeptical to being kind of moving into the kind of like the atheistic kind of mindset, basically. And that was, you know, a good couple of years really, where the only way I could survive through the experiences I was going through was by denying those experiences were happening. And also as well as that, just denying the religion that I was part of at the time as well, which I eventually, of course, chose to leave permanently. But we do need skeptics. We do need people to ask questions, but mm-hmm. believers ask questions too.
Right.
And that's the thing. Like, people seem to think skeptical minds are the only ones asking questions. You know, ultimately, skeptics and believers are the same. And I know that they're not going to like hearing that, and I get that. But skepticism is a form of belief. You're still making a decision based on the lack of evidence. And there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. Same with belief in itself. So, like I say, there may have more similarities than they think. And like I mentioned before, earlier in the conversation, that there is a third state of experiencer. Experiencer can't choose to believe or not believe. They just have that information. So, yes, I was skeptical of my own empirical evidence. But that was me kind of just trying to kind of pat over that knowledge, basically just ignore it wasn't there and just hide it away. We have different reasons for skepticism. And I can't speak for everybody. Of course, we all have our own journey. So yeah, there's every possibility anybody could change their mind. And it's quite healthy to change your mind. Just keep learning, keep taking more information in. Speak to people. Don't just think your point of view is absolute. Like, your point of view of the universe isn't absolute and applicable everywhere. And the moment you understand that, the moment you begin to enter a new realm of understanding of knowledge. I went from being religious, and I spent a good few years reading a number of books on philosophy. I highly recommend people read Stephen Hawking's A Brief History of Time, and that really hurt my brain, but I had to read it a couple of times to fully understand it. That, for him, is him explaining it in layman's terms anyway, so that shows the kind of mind that Stephen was. He was amazing. I wanted to understand the human point of view, like in terms of like a scientific perspective. I've read books on philosophy. I started to study other religions just to understand their points of view. Mm-hmm. But the moment I began to learn, just attempt to kind of tap into a tiny substrata of that big conversation about life, you know, the great conversation, my mind just opened up. I began to kind of be more sympathetic to other people's experiences and want to ask more questions about people's beliefs. And now, I spoke to a great person a while ago who told me about their belief about the concept of a jinn and, you know, spirits being a certain form of jinn and the way that kind of works. But the point is, I bothered to ask. I didn't go, okay, that's my point of the view, my point of view of the world. If anybody doesn't believe in that, they're wrong. And that's that. That no human can even begin to comprehend the greater universe. So why do we think our tiny little view point applies to everything? So yeah, so there's a bit of humbleness needed there too, really. So be okay with those changes through your life, whichever you may change from, but also understand your limitations. And you know, you're just a tiny human in amongst a great, great, beautiful tapestry of times and space and realms that are outside of our understanding. It's a beautiful place to be in, really.
I think that's a perfect way to end it. Thank you, Stan. All right, the book right here, Paranormal Perspectives, Paranormality, Normalizing the Paranormal, is available right now. We have a link in the description of this program, so you can go get it. Our author, Kieran Stanislav Mace. Stan, I want to thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me on. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
My pleasure is all mine, my friend. And again, book two comes out. Please come back on the program. Let's talk about book two.
I'll let you know. Yeah, it's in progress right now. It's certainly taking off, so watch this space. But other things are also coming for paranormality down the line, but I can't announce those just
Oh,
yet. So
all
wait and see.
right.
So
Well,
it seems to be reaching more people than I thought, actually, to my surprise.
good. Good, good. Excellent. Excellent, excellent. All right, folks, we're on the weekend. A couple of things to mention to you. One of the things I want to mention that we had mentioned yesterday, I'm going to continue it again today. Father Sean Whittington, who is on again, I'm slipping as far as the name of the show that was on Discovery. It was the Exorcist show. The League of Exorcists. That's what it was. On Discovery. His wife is ill with cancer, and he's put his business and everything to the side. His wife is having two surgeries in June and July. Life-saving surgeries. She's in very, very bad shape right now. He's put his business to the side in the meantime. Normally, I don't post GoFundMes on our site, but I'm doing this for Father Sean. Father Sean has essentially taken all money that he's made and gone out there to basically help people in their time of need, and including any money he made from books and TV and whatnot. He went out there to save people's souls, essentially. We're asking if you have any that you can spare to help Father Sean and his wife, especially with his wife at this time, trying to fight her battle with cancer. It's greatly appreciated. If you don't, it's greatly appreciated if you can put in a prayer, a thought, some sort of energy to help Father Sean's wife in her time of need with her battle of cancer. That's all we ask. If you can't donate, then please send a little bit of energy, a thought, a prayer, whatever it is that you believe in to help Father Sean's wife in this time of need. So that's greatly appreciated. Second, if you'd like to donate to help the show, you can by buying some swag. We got Darkness Radio shirts, True Crime Tuesday shirts, and whatnot. DarknessRadioShow.com. It's the shop. Go check it out. You know all about it. Third, make sure your Darkness Radio apps for Apple are updated. And fourth, we're on the weekend, and boy, we're sometime soon. We'll have good weather here in Minnesota. I think. I mean, hopefully we'll be in spring. It feels like winter out there. I mean, even as we're talking right now, it's nice out. It's 70 degrees out. Hopefully that stays. But there's spring cleanup to be done, both inside and out. Remember, this weekend, if you have a little time, if you have somebody who's elderly or disabled in your family or in your community who needs help with that spring cleanup, be a light in someone's darkness this weekend. Go help them with that. Go. It doesn't matter if you have an invitation or not. Go knock on a door. Go help somebody in your community with that. Be a light in someone's darkness this weekend. A message from your friends here at Darkness Radio. For Mally Fox, for Jessica Freeberg, for Travis Thorpe, for Beer City Brewers, I'm Tim Dennis. Thank you so much for continuing to watch and listen to the best in paranormal podcasting. This is Darkness Radio.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on two purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams Memorial Day Sale and get 30% off paints and stains May 15th through the 28th. Whether you're refreshing your interior or exterior, we've got the colors to bring your vision to life. And with delivery, getting everything to your door is easier than ever. Shop online to have it delivered or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details. Delivery available on qualifying orders.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on two purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams Memorial Day Sale and get 30% off paints and stains May 15th through the 28th. Whether you're refreshing your interior or exterior, we've got the colors to bring your vision to life. And with delivery, getting everything to your door is easier than ever. Shop online to have it delivered or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details. Delivery available on qualifying orders.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on two purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details. Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on two purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details. Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on two purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details. Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on two purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details. Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on two purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details. Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on two purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details. Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on two purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details. Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on two purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details. Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details. Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details. Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.